This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Any cook who's ever labored over a secret recipe for barbecue sauce or grandma's heirloom pickles has entertained the thought, I bet I could make a fortune if I bottled this stuff. Maybe so, but it wouldn't be easy money. Turning a secret recipe into a best-selling gourmet food item is harder than it looks. Perfecting the secret recipe is the easy part. Then there's finding an industrial kitchen where you can bottle the stuff, not to mention getting it to market, and last but not least, persuading people to buy it. A rise in demand for locally made processed goodies is driving changes in the food chain, though. In the triangle, the path from local farm to gourmet food shelf has gotten a little easier lately, and that is thanks in part to The Cookery, a commercial kitchen and business incubator in Durham. Nick Hawthorne Johnson is co-owner of The Cookery, and he joins me today, along with Carla Squires, purveyor of Bamboo Ladies Pickles, one of The Cookery's clients. Nick and Carla, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
Nick, tell us about The Cookery. What is it?
So The Cookery is a food business incubator. Essentially, we do three things. We have a certified commercial kitchen and bakery that we rent by the hour to entrepreneurs who, like you were saying, have a dream or have a great product and have a dream of taking it to market. And though, like you were saying, the easy part may be making the food, it's difficult to translate that. Just because you have a great product doesn't mean you'll be a great food business. So what else we do besides provide the facility is we provide incubation services. That is, we have a workbook to help people figure out, okay, what does it cost to make my product? How many do I need to sell? How does the business side of my business look? And we provide marketing services. We spend a lot of our energy trying to drive business to our members and trying to find retail outlets for our members' products.
The incubator part of it, of course, is very interesting, the fact that you can offer some guidance on the business side. But the kitchen part of it is no small part either. It seems to me that when I come up with a good idea, if I want to sell it, I need a commercially licensed kitchen. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of scale. I'd have to go to some large conglomerate somewhere if you weren't there just to get the stuff bottled. Forget about the fact that I don't know a thing about business.
Sure. I mean, most people who end up being able to be successful in the food business do it maybe because they have a great product and definitely because they have enough money to mostly build their own facility. So what we do is we lower the threshold for being able to get a foothold in the marketplace. We make it available to people that don't necessarily have hundreds of thousands of dollars to build their own kitchen.
So tell us what's behind this. How did this get started? You didn't start out to do this, did you?
No. We're located at 1101 West Chapel Hill Street, which is what used to be the Durham Food Co-op building. My mother, Hetty Johnson, and I bought the building in 2009 when the food co-op went out of business. And had other plans for it. And then about a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who knew Drew Brown, who works for Farmhand Foods, who's a local meat purveyor that we'll talk to, I guess, in a little bit here. And he was looking for a kitchen space to run their food truck because all food trucks need a commissary kitchen to be their base. And my friend Rob knew that we owned that building and there used to be a kitchen in it. And called to say, hey, is that kitchen still usable? And I said, and it was not usable at all. It was in horrible disrepair. And I was like, I'd love to help him, but rat infested would be an accurate description.
That took a lot of work. And you actually grew up in the neighborhood around there too. Mm-hmm. So this is a kind of personal mission in a way for you.
To do something
for that neighborhood.
We bought that building as part of we have a real estate restoration business. And so we concentrate on the West End. I live in the West End. I love that place. And we're, part of our vision for that, for the building, was to lead the transformation of that commercial corridor. And I was proud to be at the unveiling of the historic marker for Pauli Murray. Last week, which is right across the street from our building.
Great mural on the wall of that building. Yeah. Carla, you were the first person to call and book space in The Cookery. Tell us about your bamboo pickles and why you thought this would be a good idea.
Well, I had been, when I decided to make the pickles, there wasn't a commercial kitchen in the area. And the first year I made them was in 2007. So the only place available was in Asheville at Blue Ridge Food Ventures. So I would drive to Asheville in the spring when the bamboo was growing and stay at my parents' in Wilkes County or either get a hotel in Asheville. And so that made the cost of my product extremely expensive. And that was also when gas had gone up to like $4.50 a gallon. So the fact that I had a full-time job and that the cookery was open allowed me to reduce the cost of my pickles.
And how about the pickles for you, bamboo pickles? They go back a while in your family, right?
Yes, it was originally started, a lady in the community was a nurse for the government when the Panama Canal was being built. And so she brought some bamboo sprigs back to Wilkes County and planted it. And as it began to flourish, people tried to figure out what to do with it. And in the South, you know, we pickle everything. So
and then fry it. Yeah.
So there were different recipes. People tried different things. And this was a recipe that my family used, and we've changed it over the years. But my grandparents retired and moved back to Wilkes County. They lived in Lenoir, moved back, and in 1970 planted 7 sprigs of bamboo, and from now there's over 3 acres.
Yeah, it doesn't take long. If you don't have a panda, that stuff goes like crazy. So you've got it, and I'm sure, is it one of those things where whenever you gave somebody a taste of those, they said, oh, you need to sell these. These are great. You'll make a fortune.
Well, kind of, but, you know, we grew up on them. It wasn't unusual to us. So when I began to think I might do this, people really, they were intrigued by it. I did my homework and went to New York to the Fancy Food Show to see if there was anything else out there like it, and there wasn't. There were 8,000 vendors, and no one had a bamboo pickle. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to try it.
And what did you try? Because, again, the recipe is the easy part. Now you've got to figure out how to get these things into stores and get them sold.
Well, I took some classes through NC State Food Science. I went to the acidified foods class, which is pickle school, manufacturing class with people from Kraft Food, Chicago Pickle, all across the world people were there. And so I got the certification. And then, you know, you have to have a label, you have to have jars, and you have to have somewhere to make it. So it was a real learning experience to try to find all of these things for someone that had not had that background.
How are sales going for you now, and how have things changed since you don't have to make that trip to Asheville anymore?
Well, first of all, I have a full-time job, so yes, it's much easier to be able to use the cookery and to get people to help me, because in the past I would hire college students to help me pack. And so now I have the local.
Hiring college students to help you pack because their mothers pack them. So
right.
I'm not sure that'd be so profitable. Go ahead.
But so now there are people that it's easier to get people to help.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year I won an award from Cooking Light magazine as an artisanal food product in the Southeast. And then in the spring I was in the New York Times. So I sell as many pickles as I can make.
Nick, you just put out a book. Tell us about the book.
Well, the book, it's called The Food Entrepreneur's Business Planning Workbook, and it's exactly that. It's not a very exciting title, but it's a business planning workbook. The front half of it is all of the business side of the food business sort of broken down very concisely and applied to the concept of food business with examples from Jake the Baker. And the back half of the book is are a series of worksheets that you can then that are referenced in the front. So you can read the section in the front, think about, okay, how does that apply to my business? Go to the worksheet in the back that applies to that and put your numbers in and has all of the formulas there that sort of flow you through to having the numbers break down on, you know, costing and pricing and break-even volume and all of that for your business.
Now, Carla went to pickle school. Where did you learn all this stuff?
We were very fortunate. My wife and I, Rochelle, who is really the only person who is the reason that anybody takes the cookery seriously, we're very fortunate to have an intern from Fuqua Business School at Duke who helped us. I mean, I own another small business, so I have some experience, and I've worked in a lot of food business settings, managing and cooking and waiting tables and the like.
And to have both the business plan and the kitchen seems to me pretty sensible, because as your customers flourish and succeed, I guess so do you, right?
Yeah. It does us very little good to advertise ourselves to the general public, because most people are not looking to start a food business. And so we spend, my wife, Rochelle, owns Row Design Studios, which is her small marketing company. She does websites, and she designed all our materials on our website. And so she uses her talents as an advertiser and a marketer to find caterers, to find business for caterers. So we advertise, contact the cookery to find a caterer for your next event. And then that gives us the chance to say, oh, so what sort of event are you having? Who are you looking for? What's your price point? And then be able to connect you with a variety of caterers that are operating from the cookery, and then they get business, and then that generates business for us.
And, of course, all this supports local economies and keeps money flowing locally.
Absolutely.
Right, from farm to fork, through the kitchen. We're going to continue this conversation on the state of things, talking about locally made specialty foods from home, kitchen, and creator right to your cupboard. My guests are Nick Hawthorne Johnson, co-owner of The Cookery, and Carla Squires, owner of Bamboo Ladies Pickles. Carla, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Next up, The Cookery's clients. We'll talk to more of them and a man who turns sweet potatoes into kakalaki sauce on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, taking a look at how entrepreneurs turn North Carolina-grown agricultural products into the specialty foods that fill our kitchens and holiday gift baskets. My guests are Nick Hawthorne Johnson, co-owner of The Cookery, a commercial kitchen and business incubator in Durham. And joining us now by phone is Jennifer Curtis. She is the director of NC Choices, a program of the State Center for Environmental Farm Systems, and also co-owner of Farmhand Foods. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
You have approached this problem, the challenge of getting locally grown meat in particular and produce into the food chain, from the policy perspective, through your work at NC Choices, and some practical applications on your part through Farmhand Foods. First, tell us what NC Choices does.
Well, NC Choices, as you said, is an initiative of the Center for Environmental Farming Systems, and it works with pasture-based livestock producers around the state and helps them develop their businesses, and also works with the small-scale processors who do the slaughter and the packaging and the labeling, and also the market buyers. So we try to connect everyone in the supply chain and create a more vibrant, local, sustainable meat supply chain, if you will.
And that chain is a little broken at the moment because we have an industrial-based agricultural system in this country. It's kind of hard for local small farmers to even find a processor locally to process their meat and get it to the market. Is that right?
That's absolutely true. One of the things we've discovered in the last 5-6 years working with farmers around the state and with local small-scale processors was the broken chains in the supply chain, as you described. And one of the things we found was we really needed a business that could help aggregate the supply of animals and do the marketing and distribution and branding and labeling and get those products into larger scale markets. And that was really the genesis and birth of Farmhand Foods, which does just that, tries to help local small scale farmers raising pasture-based beef and pork get their products into these markets, which is hard to do on your own given the way our food system's set up.
What are some of the obstacles?
Well, one is processing, and I think that links well to Nick's work, for example. There just aren't enough small-scale meat processors in the state that do a good enough job, that create value-added products, that have the packaging needed to really compete in retail and food service environments. So we've been, working, NC Choices works closely with those processors. We've been trying to basically help that whole sector professionalize. And so that's one of the obstacles, is lack of infrastructure. And that's true for a lot of issues related to the food system.
And, you know, you're talking about, you know, you can be a pork processor, and if I want to buy a pork shoulder at the farmer's market, that's great. Maybe some chops. But what about salami, cold cuts, and that sort of thing, or hot dogs, for that matter, or sausage? Then I might be stuck going to Costco because nobody locally, I can't get it processed and turned into those kinds of cuts or those meats.
Right. There's just a handful of businesses that do value-added meat products, and that partly relates to some of the regulatory challenges we have where the cost of entry and the regulations make it really difficult for small businesses to do handcrafted meat products.
And
a little
course,
bit easier with fresh produce and this kind of thing.
And the regulations are based on an industrial system where tons and tons and tons of meat are processed, and so you need those kind of rules. But if you had a smaller facility that was more sustainable, you wouldn't need those rules. More people could get into the business.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's absolutely true that we identified, the Center for Environmental Farming Systems did in its Farm to Fork initiative and the State Action Guide was the sort of the fact that a lot of our food regulations and laws are, as you say, they're set up and designed as if farming and food production are all done on an industrial scale. And there's really a lot of room to improve creating regulations that support small-scale artisan food production and, you know, room for businesses that can come in and really help get that done, which is, I think, why it's so exciting that the cookery is doing what it's doing.
And the point is you can process food safely. It's just at a different scale, you would have different rules. It's not like relaxing the rules for smaller processors. It's safe food produced in a different environment requires different rules.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, everybody that wants to do it in a safe way. We're all about food safety. But there's just record keeping and various stipulations that have to be in place when you're doing on a massive scale. I have one example. I've been working with a new goat farm that has put in place a creamery on its farm, and when they went to go do that, they faced just a myriad of different stories from different regulatory agencies telling them whether or not they had to regulate their whey as an industrial waste. And whey is a byproduct of making cheese, but it's edible, and it's certainly not an industrial waste. And so her story actually helped promulgate new regulations in North Carolina that add clarity to the fact that you can have a small-scale winemaking facility on your farm or cheese-making, and as long as you don't cross over a certain threshold, your byproducts, which are safe, are not considered industrial waste. So there's been some progress recently in trying to add greater clarity to regulations that do impact small-scale farmers and food entrepreneurs.
Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Have a great Thanksgiving. Jennifer Curtis, director of NC Choices and co-owner of Farmhand Foods. Right now, I want to welcome two more guests to the conversation. Paige Skelton is owner of Kakalaki Barbecue Sauce. Lisa Gordon Stella makes Kismet crackers at the cookery in Durham. Paige and Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Paige, you started Kakalaki Sauce a decade ago before anybody heard of this farm-to-fork business. Do any of the challenges that Jennifer described resonate with you?
Oh, every one of them, and then some. I like to tell people I've got the battle scars to prove it. But yes.
Well, tell us about starting out with Kakalaki. What's behind it?
Well, basically, I am a home brewer, and the idea that you can make something better in your own kitchen than what at that time was readily available in the grocery store was very striking to me. It resonated with me. And I particularly like spicy condiments, and I started experimenting with this. I was a middle manager at a telecommunications company. You may have heard of it. It was called WorldCom. Mm. And I started making this sauce about that whole time when that was in the news. And every day I'd go into work, I couldn't wait to get home to start working on my recipe. And not unlike Lisa's story or Carla's story, it's my friends started buying it from me, and then I got the idea that, hey, maybe I have a viable business idea here. And here we are almost 11 years later now, and we're available in 22 states. And most recently, Costco here in North Carolina has begun adding us to their stores one by one. So it's been a really fun, hard, successful ride.
I just think it's a great story that the collapse of a multinational giant leaves you in a position to put sweet potatoes and hot sauce together and come up with something that's actually sustainable and good.
Quite ironic. every once in a while I tell folks that I would probably shake that man's hand, but I'd probably give him a good Charlie horse too.
Lisa, tell us about the cracker business and how you got started in that.
Well, I spent about 13 years as a litigator, primarily in big firms, and decided that I'd always loved to bake. And my mom was actually the one who was like, you need to sell your granola. And I said, everyone does granola. I got to do something different. And so experimented with different things I could do and kind of melded a biscotti recipe with a granola recipe and came up with this and had some friends who helped me out early on. And we experimented with different permutations of what you could do with a cracker and came up with what we thought was a really healthy alternative that makes you feel satisfied when you eat it. You know, it's not a Keebler cracker, and nothing wrong with Keebler crackers, but, you know, it's made with all sorts of healthy ingredients. I don't put any sugar. I try to put – there's almost no salt. There's no – any fat added. And for me, this was a way to – do something that I enjoyed, and I can incorporate my family. Sometimes my kids help me label the crackers, and so they may be a little crooked. And you know, it's really a labor of love. And without the cookery, it really wouldn't be possible.
Maybe they just don't like the curly pointed boots you make them wear. That could be the problem.
Yes.
So you went to the cookery. You're making them there.
Yes.
So Nick, Lisa comes to you with the cookery, and she says, "I want to make crackers." Now, what do you do then? What's the next step?
I actually met Lisa at our open house when we first opened. She and her friends came and said, you're Nick, come here. We want to look at your ovens. How many sheet pans can you fit in here? How big are these?" They had, you know, they sort of like grabbed me and dragged me away from everybody, and they were clearly very excited about it. Lisa's super self-directed. She's a litigator and knows how to navigate bureaucracy and I feel like we've been running to keep up with her. But in general, you know, somebody approaches us and says, "I'm interested in making this product," and we bring them and show them the place and talk to them about what the product is and what their process is, and then hook them up with the regulatory agency that's going to be inspecting them, whether it be the, you know, Durham County Environmental Health or North Carolina Department of Agriculture, or whoever. We work with both producer and regulator to get everybody together and get the inspections done and make sure that our facility and equipment meets the standards that are needed.
Now, in terms of marketing, though, it seems like you do have a problem because they're probably not as inexpensive as Keebler crackers either, and they're healthy. But you have to somehow get to the people who are looking for the healthy cracker so that you can get that price. That's
the most difficult part. Yeah. And I think the other component, and I think all the folks that you've probably spoken with today are – face the same obstacle, which is that when you make something that is made with really quality ingredients and it's made on a small scale, it's going to cost more money. And it's not that I want it to cost more money. It's just that is the nature of the beast. And try as most of us might, it's very hard. We reduce our cost as much as we can, and we try to pass it on. But when you're smaller, that's what you have to deal with.
Paige, we mentioned this, the not-so-secret ingredient is sweet potatoes,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely right. North Carolina sweet potatoes.
North Carolina. Yes. Did you do that? Did you place a premium on local produce?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And we found out that by sticking to the specialty markets, your Weaver Street markets, your Whole Foods, the fresh markets, the clientele is more accustomed to paying a premium price but for a premium product. So they realize that we have to eat too, and nobody's laughing all the way to the bank, that's definitely part of it. And the sweet potatoes are actually the most expensive component of this recipe. There's 23 all natural ingredients in Kakalaki spice sauce, but it just doesn't work without it, and it doesn't work out without any of those ingredients. So it's a necessary cost.
And give us a sense of now the scope. How widespread are your sales? How are you doing?
We're doing well. We're very fortunate.
You all across the country, you international yet? Or are you everywhere?
we do have international distributors, but where it goes, I have no idea.
Once it leaves the kitchen.
Yes, that's right.
You know, we're talking now about the premium, and the premium people will pay for better ingredients, for locally produced ingredients, and just getting them to the right markets. But, Nick, I mean, then the other question is, when can we start to make this available for everybody, even people who can't pay those premium prices, just need a way to figure out how to feed their families?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge and really important question. And part of Rochelle and my vision for the cookery is that we're trying to make the production of small-scale food accessible to people that don't have tremendous amounts of capital and that don't – that you don't have to take on a $6,000 a month more, you know, rent payment and buy $300,000 worth of, you know, certified, inspected, NSF-safe equipment to produce your small, you know, I mean, if you're producing hundreds and thousands of crackers, then you can afford to spend that money because you're going to make it up in volume. But if, you know, your margins on specialty foods are not high. And so if you're going to start small and you're going to be able to survive, I mean, really, it's not even about flourishing for, you know, for years and years. I mean, I don't know how many years you spent, Page, before you all turned a profit, but most right. people spend years before right. they ever turn a profit. And with us, with the cookery, instead of having the fixed cost of rent and equipment and all of that, it becomes a variable cost. So it makes sense for small-scale production up to a point where you graduate to the scale where it makes sense you don't want your space to be a variable cost anymore. You want it to be fixed so that you can make more profit per unit.
It sounds to me like this makes sense when people find themselves out of work and have a skill. They can come to. Are you seeing some of that now? People who may not have been attorneys or worked at WorldCom,
Absolutely.
But are also out of work and can actually start a business and get things going.
Absolutely, Lindsay Moriarty, whose fine donuts we were eating this morning, Monuts Donuts. I met her. She was walking around the neighborhood with a group of students from UNC, and. I thought they were unusual, and since I'm walking around the neighborhood all the time, I went and spoke with them, and she ended up calling us and interning with us. And she couldn't find a job out of college. She's got she has a master's degree, and she couldn't find a job. And so she thought, well, you know, I made donuts. Everybody loves my donuts. Maybe I'll try. And now you can buy them in the farmer's market, and you can get them delivered to your office. So.
The other interesting thing to me, and Paige, maybe I'll ask the question to you in this way, is that you learn how to run a business, which means even if somehow the Kakalaki market drops off, you now know how to run your business.
Oh, absolutely. And it's kind of a parable, actually, of people who figure out the formula, if you will, and they cookie cutter it into other things. Having said that, this is my life's work, and we have a 5-year-old son, Paige Jr., and hopefully we can pass it off to him one day.
What was the biggest obstacle to you to getting to the point now where you're actually kind of sustained?
This may sound trite, but it's absolutely true, deciding to actually do it. Everything else falls into place, you know, your nutritional data analysis, your labeling, your whatever, how are you going to get it made, all that stuff, but actually committing. Being committed, but, as the case may be. But.
Lisa, how about you? What was the biggest obstacle?
I would say that I agree with Paige that once you commit to an idea that you want to do this and you're willing to put in as much effort as it takes, I think you're halfway there. I'm still not profitable, but at the same time, I think it's important to have that in your head that this is what you want to do. And if you enjoy what you're doing, it makes every day much better.
Amen.
But Nick, and that also points to this bigger question. You know, so many of us in this global economy are dependent on big corporations for jobs, and that's been our mindset. Mm-hmm. And then we give tax incentives to big companies to come in and give us the jobs that we're on our knees for. It seems to me that a subtle message and benefit of all this is giving people the confidence to do what they do best, to work where their heart is, and not only that, but the knowledge and the means to actually get started and get off that job train and onto something more sustainable.
Absolutely. I mean, that nothing makes me prouder than, I mean, when you do what Rochelle and I do, run an incubator, you're proudest and maybe bittersweet moment is to have your best customers leave you because they did well. And they, you know, like Daisy Cakes, who is now open on Foster Street, they were in the cookery. They got big enough that it made sense for them to have their own place. And to see people create a livelihood for themselves out of something that they love is hugely inspiring.
And you've got big plans for the building now, because right now you're kind of only using the back end, right?
Yeah. At the moment, we occupy about the rear 1,200 square feet. It's a production kitchen and bakery and cold storage areas and such. And thank you very much to the city of Durham for they just approved us, we found out this week, for $15,000 in matching funds through the Office of Economic and Workforce Development to upfit the front of the space, which currently looks very sadly abandoned. So,
and what are you going to do there?
It will become an event space. We will have it to do classes. We will have it to host food shows. I want to have a Triangle Fancy Food Show where we bring in all the local producers and bring the public in. It'll be available for receptions and catered events and functions. I'm a Iron Chef. I have a dream of a Frank Statio, Dick Gordon Iron Chef.
Throw down.
I will make my world famous Italian sausage there and sell it only at the holidays.
I'm all for
that
it.
That sounds great. Well, and congratulations to the city of Durham for recognizing that investment in local economies is really the way to go. And congratulations to you and all of you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nick Hawthorne Johnson, co-owner of The Cookery in Durham. Carla Squires makes Bamboo Ladies Pickles. We want to thank her, as well as Lisa Gordon Stella, who makes Kismet Crackers, Paige Skelton, purveyor of Kakalaki Barbecue Sauce and Spicy Sauce, all of them on the program today. If you want to pick up some of those and other fine produce for Thursday's feast, local farmers markets are open this afternoon. It's special to get all that stuff you forgot at the Saturday market. So here's the list of farmers markets open today, this afternoon. Carrboro, North Raleigh, and Durham farmers markets open 2 to 5. Chapel Hill Market goes from 2 to 6. Eno and Western Wake farmers markets 3 to 6. Chatham Market noon to 3. And then tomorrow, Wake Forest farmers markets. Point is, they're open today. If you didn't get the times, go to their website and you will find out more. Get to the farmers market and get what you need for Thanksgiving. Coming up, a new symphony composition by Laura Lynn Dossett sets the journey home for the holidays to music. Stay with us on The State of Things.